is the One Ocean Hub podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the One Ocean Hub podcast and to the second part of our episode 4, Women of the Sea, where we got together with two South African scholars and activists, Buchle Francis and Apiwe Mushani, who are both One Ocean Hub early career researchers and the winners of the British Council Scotland Earth Scholarships. In part one, they spoke of the challenges that women in coastal communities face in their everyday lives, from injustices they suffer in labor relations to the impact of the climate change on the ocean that they get to experience firsthand. They also shared their own experiences as women ocean researchers from Global South and the challenges they face and tackle in their work. And we also focused on some of Buchle's and Apiwe's new exciting work, Apiwe's PhD research on gender and blue economy, and Buchle's research that she undertook with women seaweed harvesters from Eastern Cape in South Africa as her co-researchers. So this was participatory research that they undertook together. And before we dive into part two, have a listen to some highlights from part one.
So I want to be very responsible with how I respond to questions of the blue economy. And also speaking about gender in particular, but just roughly, I would say the blue economy is sort of a concept that is within the umbrella of sustainable development. And I think sustainable development is a buzzword that we've heard within the sort of environmental sciences or across disciplines. I think you both will agree post its inception. And I think the blue economy in particular, along with similar concepts like the green economy, are sort of, the child of sustainable development and are seen as the very practical initiatives or the practical ways that we can achieve sustainability within our lifetime. And by that, I mean the economic development that does not compromise human needs and societal needs more broadly. The blue economy in particular seeks to carry forward this initiative or this idea of sustainability within the ocean environment. So it's defined pretty similarly in that it's an initiative that seeks to realize economic development goals without compromising our goals to conserve the ocean environment and the needs of society more broadly. And so the contention of it, that is quite clear, comes from this idea of trying to realize these very contentious goals that often have been conflicting and impossible to marry within the context or the lens rather of perceiving development in a very narrow, once again, neoliberal perspective, because development does not necessarily mean economic expansion. And I think for a long time, economic growth has been used as a proxy to development, which I think is highly problematized in literature.
Others would call it an interventionist kind of research. Others will call it an action research. Others will call it, but mainly, what are you going to do? My question is, okay, I've listened, heard, and seen. Then what? Do I leave it like that? Publish a paper, get an award, getting as many publications as I can, what does it mean to the community? So in this case, together with the women, we want to see justice. We want to see intervention.
Listening to the both of you, it's just so important to bring up these conversations about ethics and values within research, right? Particularly community-based research. And I think, yes, we see that these issues are a local manifestation, but we know that these are simply a manifestation of what occurs structurally in broader society. And so these challenges may be local, but research and literature will support the fact that these are sort of, it's a trickle-down effect of what happens globally and internationally. And so, yeah, I really think that that's something that academics need to think very honestly and candidly about, as you mentioned, Buchle, and thinking about the kind of very tangible outputs that research can provide locally. So as your project does with the sewing, especially.
Thank you so much for that fantastic answer and for the nuggets of wisdom that you gave us about this, and for presenting us the story that's not easy one bit, but that makes us thinking about what are these words that are thrown around, such as sustainability, such as equality, such as rights, the ability to exercise them, or the beautifully written words on the paper that we all hope to uphold, but somehow they don't get upheld and enjoyed by the people who they refer to, and how the coastal communities, who should be in the heart of decision making, and who should be in the heart of knowledge production or co-production, oftentimes fall off the grid and are not seen. They're invisibilized in many ways, and we're at the hub. We're trying to co-create the knowledge and to influence or at least inform this decision making and policy making. So these large cosmetic companies who hire women to harvest seaweed, but do not provide contracts, nor they take responsibility for providing the support when harvesters are injured on the job. This is something that you speak to, and this is something that you illuminate, Buchle. Some of this research and some of this activities that you engaged with these women informed and linked to one of the publications that came out recently that you co-authored, Buchle, with Dylan McGarry. And the edited collection is entitled Hydrofeminist Thinking with Oceans, yes. Political and Scholarly Possibilities. And it recently came out, and it's really exciting. And I read through it, and I really, really enjoyed it. It's about five women from Hosa Ocean Elders, so grandmothers of the sea again. Also, can you help me pronounce Hosa?
It's all about the click. It's all about the click.
Yeah. I'm not very good at saying this. I can roll the r, but I can't do good speaking in Hosa. So could you tell me more about your chapter and about the collaboration that you had with Dylan on there?
Working with Dylan is very exciting all the time, because he has this artistic way that he brings, and also it helps a lot when you are doing information dissemination or sharing, because it makes these visuals, which makes it so easier for the people to get the message. And so it was such a powerful collaboration with him here, but more important to speak about maybe the editors also from Western Cape University, who invited us, and this has led to another opportunity where I am going to present in London in this conference called the title of the conference is Persist, Resist, and Colonialism. Yeah, in the face of climate change. It's where we find most. Yes, so it's where we find most of these activists and people who are speaking about injustices around the world. I'm sure it would be very exciting. So they are the ones who invited me to come and speak about this chapter, which I'm already sharing with you. So in this chapter, it's about the five elders, the five Xhosa grandmothers. I asked them, why are you calling yourselves grandmothers? They are saying they're calling themselves grandmothers because a grandmother is a mother to somebody, and they feel like mothering their families and at the same time mothering the ocean as well, because of basically their age in general, and because of who they are within the society. They are senior citizens of in their villages, so they call themselves, and also we call somebody who's a senior citizen and of that age, a grandmother. So something that ugogo, you know, something that umakulu, something that comes natural. So yes, so I interviewed five of them. And why only five of them among all the women? These were the most senior citizens ones. And I felt that, okay, I mean, surely they have so much knowledge, and it's worth it maybe to find time to start speaking to such people who are more senior in terms of age than others. I mean, thinking, okay, yeah, since they are there, they've been there the longest. So that's what informed. But I wouldn't also speak to almost everyone. So I just thought, well, five will work, just perfect, fantastic. Also looking at the distance and the location, and yeah, so I just wanted to speak to the five of them. And each one of them has a different relationship, which is almost similar, but very different and unique in a small way with the ocean. So this is what the first thing I want to highlight. And the first things they highlight in the chapter is their gender norms as they were growing up, were already going to the ocean. They were taken by their mothers, not by their fathers. So the mothers brought them, introduced them to the ocean, like as they were young, though they were born there. You know, there's a certain age when you start to notice a difference, maybe as young as 4 years, 5 years. Then that's when you accompany your mother to go and pick up the mussels, to go and pick up maybe seaweed. So this is how the chapter begins, where they recall how it was then and how it is now and what has changed over time and what is not working now and what worked.
So then you explored and portrayed what happened after they made this embodied habitual bond with the ocean and after they established this embodied knowledge of it, knowledge that they just had just by being on the coast, because they were brought there by their mothers and their grandmothers and their elders. And then you wrote about what happened after that direct relationship that they had got intercepted by the governments and by the industries and by the companies, right? Yeah, and how their relationship with the ocean and their knowledge that developed got sidelined. And with that, they got excluded from decision making, which kind of continued without their involvement.
And all the laws that have come now to suppress them and oppress them, and which the laws which they are told. One interesting thing, One interesting thing which they speak more about, for example, one of the grandmothers speaks about permits and other things. He says, what is interesting is when the government has something which they want us to be aware of, like, for example, don't harvest here, things like MPS, don't go there to harvest, don't go there. They are able to send the message to everyone. This is very interesting. But when it's something which affects them and when they want to contribute, there's no communication. There's literally that gap and they can't be reached. And for example, when there are important programs which are taking place, all of a sudden the government will be incapacitated to reach them. But when it comes to things like all the things which evolve about don't do this, don't do that, the government is able to reach them. So those are some of the things which they highlight in the chapter. But more importantly, they bring out the knowledge that they have about the ocean, where they speak about not using a GPS to locate which type of fish is where, because they naturally know where you can find certain species, when, in which season, and how. So I found that very interesting, especially if you look at how science have evolved now, where sometimes you need to call a certain species for you to monitor. They don't need that because they have that knowledge already. And I feel like we're losing out for not tapping to such knowledge, because I feel like this knowledge could be put together, you know, it will be so helpful. And then they speak about, actually, I must also mention that when the conversation took place, when I interviewed them, it was the time when the government was rolling out a lot of programs which were done online because of COVID. We had what we call OEMP, Oceans Economic Master Plan, which the government was just putting out there to people to comment, but it was done on Zoom. So none of them would attend Zoom they didn't even know that it was happening. It was time also when most of the MPAs were being like Amatole MPA was being introduced. they were not even aware of it because also it was happening online. And the things were happening online also because of COVID. Remember, we had just come out of COVID. It was not even post-COVID, but we were in a level where you would still not be able to visit the communities. And so most things were done online. But then still there was a window where I felt like the government had an opportunity to consult physically in those meetings. When the government tried to do that, the meetings were sort of like a disaster because the time was very short, there were no translators, the PowerPoints, boring PowerPoints, most people didn't even attend those meetings. So to them, it was like they remained excluded. So they speak about that, their struggle to be consulted, their struggle of not participating in any decision making, and especially in things that affect them. For example, there's also been oil and gas that has been happening around the coastline, and most of the consultants were not able to reach out to them. And yeah, so they also speak about things like that, that look, we have not been consulted. Sometimes we hear from people that there's been such a program, but we have not been part of it. Whereas we are the people that live here and the ocean is actually ours because we are the ones that are looking after it. And it speaks to us, we listen to it and we know what it means. Those waves are just not only waves to you, they could be waves, but to us they mean something. So yeah, so it's basically about their experiences. And also, interestingly, about conserving the species and looking after the ocean. They know which fish to catch and when they catch which one to release back and not to kill. So they really have that sustainable method of harvesting, which, yeah, I feel if all who were to listen would benefit so much from it. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of these things where the knowledge of local communities who know this in their bodies, through their generations, because they are physically embodied and connected with the ocean, is superior, and the one that officially imposed from the various governments and international companies falls short. I am a great fan of that chapter, and I recommend everybody to read this chapter by Dr. Buchla Francis and by Dr. Dylan McGarry, who's one of the co-directors of One Ocean Hub, whose illustrations grace a lot of our publications as well. Wonderful. So in terms of this knowledge, and we're talking about the knowledge a lot in this podcast, I feel, and I would like to bring in Apiwe and ask her about, on top of everything that you do, Apiwe, and your quite multifaceted expertise and your, I would say, interdisciplinary research, you have also recently started as a research trainee at UNITAR, co-developing the One Ocean Learn platform. And I'm really happy to collaborate with you on it. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the platform and about your role in it, and specifically about the learning pathway on the platform that's entitled Gender and the Ocean.
Thank you so much, Melissa, for that question. And thank you, Buhle, for just the perfect segue. As you were speaking about knowledge production, I started getting goosebumps thinking about the kind of work that we do as part of the One Ocean Hub, but as well as on the knowledge translation platform that has been created in collaboration with the United Nations Institute for Training and Research, or UNITAR, as Melissa called it. So my role as a traineeship really has been to sort of conceptualize and design this idea of a virtual platform for integrated knowledge translation. So as we've sort of highlighted the significance of knowledge, and not only knowledge in the sense of academic information, but of course, according to the ethos of the One Ocean Hub, which is to really center the stories of local communities and people who have lived experiences. And really the ethos of the One Ocean Learn is to sort of hold this incredible knowledge that's been collected and put together by a number of individuals, organizations, including hub researchers in particular. But really the objective was to make accessible these this different way of knowing the ocean, particularly because of the kind of work that the One Ocean Hub does, you know, films that the One Ocean Hub has put together in collaboration with local artists and local young people who engage the ocean in the East Coast in particular. It ranges from academic papers that researchers of the One Ocean Hub have put together, blog posts, to sort of make accessible this information that would otherwise be sitting in an academic database that's inaccessible. And I think that's one of the most unfortunate things about academia is the inaccessibility of the knowledge that we produce and the knowledge and the information that we, the discourse rather, that we sort of all engage in. And I think what makes these academic sources useful is their accessibility. And so what the One Ocean Learn does is to serve as this knowledge platform where one can find all kinds of resources about ocean governance that range from children's rights within the ocean environment and to gender in the ocean, as Melitza highlighted. And I think, you know, coming on board as a person who's supporting the conceptualization and design of this virtual platform has really been such a treat, as well as, you know, supporting the content that and production that Melitza is actually putting together in using art-based tools to inform ocean governance as part of the United Nations Climate Change Learning Partnership, or UNCC Learn. And so one of these learning initiatives within the One Ocean Learn are called learning pathways. What learning pathways are sort of structured as courses, but instead of certification, we have simply a quiz that appears at the end of the learning pathway, where one is able to access this knowledge that One Ocean Hub researchers and others have created regarding specific issues, in this particular case, gender and the ocean. And what the One Ocean Learn really seeks to do is really tap into knowledge that would otherwise be missed and knowledge that is not necessarily mainstreamed, and targeting stakeholders and actors outside of the academic space. So here we have policy advisors or policy makers, as we've called them on this podcast, but also students, young people, teachers, artists, community-based organizers, because it's important for us to, yes, disseminate academic knowledge and make academic knowledge accessible, but also help capacitate those who seek to organize in local communities with accurate and up-to-date information. And one of the most powerful things about the One Ocean Learn platform itself is the accessibility of knowledge in this way, but also the up-to-date and accurate information that one can access.
Fantastic. And we are so lucky to have you join the project, and you're an immense asset to it. And it's my great pleasure to work with you, Apiwa. And yeah, I just want to like follow up a little bit, because we talk about gender. It's the topic of this episode is gender in the ocean. And you took part in developing the learning pathway on gender in the ocean with our colleague, Sarah Cummings. So if you could just tell us briefly what's in the learning pathway, what's in the LP?
So we really tried in this learning pathway to draw on issues of inclusion, in particular, the role of the marginalization of women in ocean governance and decision-making processes, but also really having a sort of holistic approach to gender in reference to the role that people who are not women and how the influence of men in the fisheries environment affects women, particularly from a household perspective, in that, yes, we can have the information that we share about the inclusion of women in decision-making processes, but it also matters what women do in their households, as I've mentioned before, and what women do or can do in their communities, as women are in community with men as well. And so the learning pathways really seeks to bring light to some of the work that Hub researchers has done in that regard. But an interesting thing that this particular learning pathway highlights is also different ways of thinking about what role women can play, what role women do play in the ocean governance sphere, ranging from different fisheries sector, of course highlighting the role women play within small-scale fishing in particular, because of the nature of the research that One Ocean Hub is really focused on in ocean-dependent communities. And so we know that we want to highlight the role, the vulnerabilities that women face as in the context of climate change in particular. Women and children are particularly more vulnerable to climate-related shocks, but also women who are small-scale fishers and women who engage within the ocean space are particularly vulnerable to changes in the climate. And so the learning pathway itself is really designed to really draw on this interesting and relevant pressing discourse about women, the ocean, and the climate nexus.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Apiwe. Buhle, you're smiling.
Yes, it's just so lovely to listen to Apiwe talking and unpacking it. And
yeah, no, we're developing it now, and we're going to share it with you, Buhle, and please get engaged with it, and we would absolutely cherish your feedback. But also, I am so glad and I am so happy to see this best practices in terms of women scholars happening on this podcast now, and to see you two bigging up each other and really being interested in each other's research is just a beautiful thing to behold. And I'm a great fan of both, as you know. And on that note, I would like to thank you very, very, very much for taking time to talk to us today. And I can't wait for this episode to come out, and I can't wait for everybody to hear it. So thank you both very much.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you so much.
This is the One Ocean Hub podcast.